Smart as a whip, Joe, I said to myself, and laughed. Chapter 20. Roscoe and I danced around the service alley together like players in the dugout, watching the winning run roar out of sight. Then we hustled over to the Chevy and raced the mile back to our hotel. Ran into the lobby, into the elevator, unlocked our room, and fell in. The telephone was ringing. It was Finley on the line from Margrave again. He sounded as excited as we were.
Molly Beth Gordon just called, he said. She did it. She's got the files we need. She's flying down here, right now. She told me it was amazing stuff. Sounded high as a kite. Atlanta arrivals, 2 o'clock. I'll meet you there. Delta from Washington. Picard give you anything?
Sure did, I said. He's quite a guy. I got the rest of the printout, I think.
You think?
Finley said.
You don't know?
Only just got back, I said. Haven't looked at it yet.
So look at it, for Christ's sake,
he said.
It's important, right?
See you later, Harvard guy, I said. We sat down at the table over by the window, unzipped the little plastic bag and pulled out the paper, unfolded it carefully. It was a sheet of computer paper. The top inch had been torn off the right-hand corner. Half the heading had been left behind. It said, Operation E Unum.
Operation E Unum Pluribus, Roscoe said.
Underneath was a triple-spaced list of initials with telephone numbers opposite. The first set of initials was PH. The phone number was torn off.
Paul Hubbell, Roscoe said. His number and the other half of the heading was what Finley found.
I nodded. Then there were four more sets of initials. The first two were WB and KK. They had phone numbers alongside. I recognized a New York area code against KK. The WB area code, I figured I'd have to look up. The third set of initials was JS. The code was 504, New Orleans area. I'd been there less than a month ago. The fourth set of initials was MBG. There was a phone number with a 202 area code. I pointed to it so Roscoe could see it.
Molly Beth Gordon, she said. Washington, D.C.
I nodded again. It wasn't the number I had called from the Rosewood office. Maybe her home number. The final two items on the torn paper were not initials, and there were no corresponding phone numbers. The second-to-last item was just two words, Stoller's Garage. The last item was three words, Gray's Kleiner File. I looked at the careful capital letters, and I could just about feel my dead brother's neat, pedantic personality bursting off the page. Paul Hubbell we knew about. He was dead. Molly Beth Gordon we knew about. She'd be here at 2 o'clock. We'd seen the garage up at Sherman Stoller's place on the golf course. It held nothing but two empty cartons. That left the underlined heading, three sets of initials with three phone numbers and the three words, Gray's Kleiner File. I checked the time. Just past noon. Too early to sit back and wait for Molly Beth to arrive. I figured we should make a start. First, we think about the heading, I said. E Unum Pluribus. Roscoe shrugged.
That's the U.S. motto, right? She said. The Latin thing?
No, I said. It's the motto backwards. This more or less means out of one comes many, not out of many comes one.
Could Joe have written it down wrong?
She said. I shook my head. I doubt it, I said. I don't think Joe would make that kind of a mistake. It must mean something. Roscoe shrugged again.
It doesn't mean anything to me, she said. What else?
Gray's Kleiner File, I said. Did Gray have a file on Kleiner?
Probably, Roscoe said. He had a file on just about everything. Somebody spat on the sidewalk, he'd put it in a file.
I nodded, stepped back to the bed and picked up the phone, called Finley down in Margrave. Baker told me he'd already left, so I dialed the other numbers on Joe's printout. The WB number was in New Jersey, Princeton University, Faculty of Modern History. I hung up straight away. Couldn't see the connection. The KK number was in New York City, Columbia University, Faculty of Modern History. I hung up again. Then I dialed JS in New Orleans. I heard one ringtone and a busy voice.
15 Score, detectives,
the voice said. Detectives, I said. Is that the NOPD?
15 Squad,
the voice said again.
Can I help you?
You got somebody there with the initials JS, I asked.
JS,
the voice said.
I got 3 of them. Which one do you want?
Don't know, I said. Is the name Joe Reacher mean anything to you?
What the hell is this?
The voice said.
20 questions or something?
Ask them, will you? I said. Ask each JS if they know Joe Reacher. Will you do that? I'll call back later, okay? Down in New Orleans, the 15th Squad desk guy grunted and hung up. I shrugged at Roscoe and put the phone back on the nightstand. We wait for Molly? She said. I nodded. I was a little nervous about meeting Molly. It was going to be like meeting a ghost connected to another ghost. We waited at the cramped table in the window, watched the sun fall away from its noontime peak, wasted time passing Joe's torn printout back and forth between us. I stared at the heading, E unum pluribus, out of one comes many. That was Joe Reacher, in 3 words. Something important, all bound up in a wry little pun. Let's go, Roscoe said. We were early, but we were anxious. We gathered up our things, rode the elevator to the lobby, and let the dead guys settle up for our phone calls. Then we walked over to Roscoe's Chevy, started threading our way around to arrivals. It wasn't easy. The airport hotels were planned for people heading out of arrivals or heading into departures. Nobody had thought of people going our way.
We don't know what Molly looks like, Roscoe said.
But she knows what I look like, I said. I look like Joe. The airport was vast. We saw most of it as we crabbed over to the right quarter. It was bigger than some cities I'd been in. We drove for miles, found the right terminal, missed a lane change and passed the short-term parking, came around again and lined up at the barrier. Roscoe snatched the ticket and eased into the lot. Go left, I said. The lot was packed. I was craning over, looking for spaces. Then I saw a vague black shape slide by in the line on my right. I caught it out of the corner of my eye. Go right, I said. I thought it was the rear end of a black pickup, brand new, sliding by on my right. Roscoe hauled the wheel over and we swung into the next aisle. Caught a flash of red brake lights in black sheet metal. A pickup swung out of sight. Roscoe howled down the aisle and cornered hard. The next aisle was empty. Nothing moving, just ranks of automobiles standing quiet in the sun. Same thing in the next aisle. Nothing on the move. No black pickup. We drove all over the lot. Took us a long time. We were held up by the cars moving in and out, but we covered the whole area. Couldn't find a black pickup anywhere. But we did find Finley. We parked up in an empty space and started the long walk to the terminal. Finley had parked in a different quarter and was walking in on a different diagonal. He walked the rest of the way with us. The terminal was very busy, and it was huge. Built low, but it spread horizontally over acres. The whole place was crowded. Flickering screens high up announced the arrivals. The 2 o'clock Delta from Washington was in and taxiing. We walked down toward the gate. Felt like a half-mile walk. We were in a long corridor with a ribbed rubber floor. A pair of moving walkways ran down the center of the corridor. On the right was an endless row of bright, gaudy advertisements about the attractions of the Sun Belt. Business or pleasure, it was all down here, that's for sure. On the left was a glass partition, floor to ceiling, with a white etched stripe at eye level to stop people trying to walk through the glass. Behind the glass were the gates. There was an endless sequence of them. The passengers came out of the planes and walked along on their side of the glass. Half of them disappeared sideways into the baggage claim areas. Then they came out again and found exit doors in the glass partition which let them out into the main corridor. The other half were the short-haul flyers with no checked baggage. They went straight to the doors. Each set of doors was mobbed by big knots of meters and greeters. We pushed our way through them as we headed down. Passengers were spilling out of the doors every 30 yards. Friends and relatives were moving in close, and the two streams of people were colliding. We fought through 8 separate crowds before we got to the right gate. I just pushed my way through. I felt anxious. The glimpse of the black pickup in the lot had unsettled me. We reached the gate. We walked on our side of the glass right past the doors, right down to level with the end of the jetway. People were already coming off the plane. I watched them spilling out of the jetway and turning to walk up toward the baggage area and the exit doors. On our side of the glass, people were walking down to the gates farther on. They were pushing at us as they passed. We were being dragged down the corridor, like swimming in a heavy sea. We were stepping backward all the time just to stay standing still. There was a stream of people behind the glass. I saw a woman coming in who could have been Molly. She was about 35, dressed well in a business suit, carrying a briefcase and a garment bag. I was standing there trying to get recognized, but she suddenly saw somebody else and pointed and gave a silent shriek behind the glass and blew a kiss to a guy 10 yards from me. He shouldered backward toward the doors to wait for her. Then it seemed like just about any of the women could be Molly. There must have been a couple of dozen candidates. There were blondes and brunettes, tall ones, short ones, pretty ones, homely ones, all dressed for business, all carrying efficient luggage, all striding in with the weary, purposeful manner of tired executives in the middle of a busy day. I watched them all. They flowed with the tide behind the glass, some of them peering out for husbands, lovers, drivers, business contacts, some of them looking straight ahead, all of them carried along in the swarming crowd. One of them had matching burgundy leather luggage, a heavy briefcase in one hand and a carry-on which she was wheeling on a long handle with the other. She was small, blonde, excited. She slowed as she turned out of the jetway and scanned the crowd through the glass. Her eyes flashed past me, then they snapped back. She looked straight at me, stopped. People piled up behind her. She was pushed forward. She fought her way over to the glass. I moved in close on my side. She stared at me, smiled, greeted her dead lover's brother with her eyes. "Molly?" I mouthed through the glass at her. She held up the heavy briefcase like a trophy, nodded toward it, smiled a big, wide smile of excited triumph. She was pushed in the back, borne along by the crowd toward the exit. She looked back to see if I was following. Roscoe and Finley and I struggled after her. On Molly's side of the glass, the flow was with her. Our side, it was against us. We were being separated at double speed. There was a solid mob of college kids bearing down on us, aiming to fly out of a gate further down. Big, well-fed kids, clumsy luggage, rowdy. The three of us were shoved backward 5 yards. Through the glass, Molly was way ahead. I saw her blonde head disappear. I fought sideways and vaulted over onto the moving walkway. It was going the wrong way. I was carried another 5 yards before I made it over the moving hand grip onto the other side. Now I was going in the right direction, but the walkway was a solid mass of people just standing still on it, content with the snail's pace the rubber floor was carrying them. They were standing 3 abreast, no way through at all. I climbed up onto the narrow handrail and tried to walk along it like a tightrope. I had to crouch because I couldn't balance. I fell heavily to my right, got carried 5 yards the wrong way before I could struggle up. I looked around in panic. Through the glass, I could see Molly was being crowded into the baggage claim. I could see Roscoe and Finley were way behind me. I was moving slowly the wrong way. I didn't want Molly to go into the baggage claim. She'd flown down here in a hurry. She had urgent news. No way would she have packed the big valise. No way would she have checked any luggage. She shouldn't be going into the baggage claim. I put my head down and ran, barged people out of the way. I was traveling against the pace of the walkway. The rubber floor was grabbing at my shoes. Each impact was costing me time. People were yelling in outrage. I didn't care. I tore through them and left them sprawling, vaulted off the walkway and clawed through the crowd at the exit doors. The baggage claim was a wide, low hall, lit with dull yellow lights. I fought my way in through the exit lane, looking everywhere for Molly. Couldn't find her. The hall was jammed with people. There must have been 100 passengers standing around the carousel, 3 deep. The belt was grinding around under a heavy load of bags. There were ragged lines of luggage carts on the sidewall. People were lining up to put quarters in a slot and pull them free. They were wheeling them away through the crowd. Carts were clashing and tangling. People were pushing and shoving. I waded into the mass, shouldered my way through, and spun people around, searching for Molly. I'd seen her go in. I hadn't seen her come out.